Do you like to be the first? Name of your sex tape? Well, if you like to be the first to listen to podcasts, you might want to check out our Patreon, because now we're offering a brand new membership tier called Name of Your Sex Tape. I couldn't help it, guys. I'm sorry. For £5 a month, you'll get an ad-free version of our weekly episode on a Tuesday, a full day earlier than its usual release. So you can be the very first to talk about how funny our guest was, how quickly you cracked the case, or how badly I answered a question. Plus, you'll get all the benefits of our regular tier, including our live Zoom records, a special shout out on the podcast, and if you really like to hear us talk, we've got an entire back catalog of extra content. Check it out on patreon.com/drunkwomensolvingcrime.
Name of your sex tape. Name of your sex tape.
Name of your sex tape.
Fancy coming along to see Drunk Women Solving Crime live?
Ooh, yes, please.
Why not join us for our monthly London residency at the marvellous Museum of Comedy? We've got monthly shows through to June.
Plus, every show is a double header, so you get to see us record not one, but two episodes with two fantastic guests.
You can find tickets on our website, drunkwomensolvingcrime.com.
Shows are selling out fast, so be quick.
Noice.
Noice.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Drunk Women Solving Crime, which was of course recorded remotely with everyone safely tucked up in their own homes. And as we get used to the new technology, it does mean that the audio in this particular episode isn't quite up to our usual standards. But we have come up with the solution and eradicated this problem for future episodes. So do bear with us. We hope everybody out there is doing well, and we can't wait to see you again when our live shows are allowed to continue. But now pour a drink and enjoy Drunk Women Solving Crime with Ruth Brett.
Drunk Women Solving Crime.
Is Drunk Women Solving Crime. My name's Katie Wilkins and I'm an author and comedian. I'm joined by screenwriter Hannah George.
Hello.
And writer-comedian Taylor Glenn.
Hello.
This is where brandy meets bludgeoning, mimosa meets misdemeanor, and port meets prostitution. It's a true crime podcast with a twist of lime. Coming up on Drunk Women Solving Crime.
The Pharmacist Roadshow, where we were it was basically like a thing called Ask Your Pharmacist. This is very early in my career. It was
Now I've written a joke and you will have to listen to it. Are you ready for this?
She was out of toilet paper because she was really lazy.
And she later considered it a catalyst that sent her in a downward spiral.
I wonder what mine's going to be. I'm really excited about that.
Now it's time for Drunk Women Solving Crime.
This is Drunk Women Solving Crime from four separate bunkers. our first non-studio record, remote record with a real guest.
Yay!
So it is my great pleasure to introduce the fantastic writer, performer, improviser, Ruth Brett!
Yay!
We normally clap, but it might ruin the sound.
Just wave.
Ruth, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, it's a funny old time, isn't it?
It is a funny old time.
Funny old time.
Please, can you tell us, have you ever been the victim of a crime?
I have. Once that I can remember. I'm sure more than once. But it's one of those ones where I was like, oh, it's so bad because it's so stereotypical and I didn't want it to be stereotypical, yeah. But it is. I went to Liverpool and I was doing the pharmacist roadshow, where we were it was basically like a thing called Ask Your Pharmacist, and it was to encourage people. This is very early in my career. It was it was to encourage people to go to their pharmacist rather than the doctor. You know, and so if you've got, you know, like little aches and pains, you should go to your pharmacist. You shouldn't bother your GP, you know. So this is before 111 and all of that. Right. And so we were doing this thing. We had a bear costume that we had to take in turns to get into.
No.
We used to do
the
like
bear represented.
I can't remember what it was.
Somebody's sadism, I guess.
I don't know. So anyway, so we were going around the whole country, and we'd got as far as Liverpool, and literally within half an hour of opening up the trailer, someone had nicked my bag with all of my credit cards. I mean, you know, I didn't have credit card, but with my bank card, my wallet, my just everything. And because we were literally going to a different city every day, yeah. I couldn't get a bank card delivered to me.
Oh,
I didn't know where I was going to be when the bank card arrived.
Oh, wow.
So I just had to borrow money from the other people in the car.
Wow. Can I just confirm, were you dressed as a bear when they stole your handbag? Because
I believe at the time I was dressed as a witch.
Wait, this is more and more like...
Then you're like, oh, a bag doesn't really go with this witch outfit. So
right, so you have to put it down. And also, I had a really bad UTI at the same time. Liverpool is the worst city in the world. Bless all the people who were doing the tour with me. They went to a shop and they bought me a replacement bag because I didn't have a bag. And I still have that bag and I still use it.
But it's really ugly, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That I didn't get back, that I have never heard the end of. I'd borrowed my mum's copy of The Go-Between to read while I was on tour. And my mum had got all of her notes from 20 years of teaching in the book. And the book was in the bag. It went, and you know that just went into a bin, you know.
Yeah.
And so yeah, my mum's every now and then will sort of go, do you remember that I had lots of good ideas in that book?
Oh no.
All right, mum, sorry.
No. Yeah. Oh no. Maybe the thieves read The Go-Between and got a real insight with all the notes and learnt about like repression and wasted lives, and then they changed their ways after that.
Maybe they changed their ways. I think given what they spent money on my cards, they bought a lot of very cheap booze.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I love it. Like, you know, when you see the shop that they've been into, how much money, and you go, oh.
Yeah. Wow.
Are you sure that was definitely them, though?
Yeah. At the time, it could have been me very easily.
But, yeah. It didn't flag a suspicious spending.
So did you actually on this tour get like, was there a pharmacist with you or was it all actors? I'm just thinking about your UTI.
We did have pharmacists with us, so in each city we'd get different pharmacists, so like local pharmacists would come and join us. She wasn't a witch. I wasn't dressed as a witch. I was dressed as a wise woman. I was dressed as like, you know, like a herbalist from
like a kind of a hippie chakra kind of.
Yeah, but old school.
So, okay.
What would have been called a witch when she was doing her herbal.
Yeah. Were you giving out homeopathy and you just don't want to say?
Yeah, that's what I was doing.
I was something of a wise woman.
We had like all the herbs in the truck was amazing. Like it had all the herbs and all the stuff that you would have used in the olden days.
Yeah.
And then we had like an old pill maker, you know, like the pharmacist used to have, so you could make your own pills.
Wow.
It was really, like, genuinely actually quite fascinating.
Your disclaimer at the beginning was like, this was the beginning of my career. And in my head, I'm like, this would be me peaking. Yeah. This would be the peak of my career. The pharmacy tour. I did the pharmacy tour.
We have to ask all our guests, what would you say if you had the perps? Now, they're under arrest. They can't see you unless you want them to. But like, what would you say to them?
I'd say, if you're gonna if you're going to nick a bag, just take the bag, then take out all the stuff that you know you're just going to chuck away.
Items, yeah.
And then if you are going to steal a bag, spend the money somewhere good. Like, at least make it worth everyone's while. Wow. I was just annoyed that they'd cost me so much time and energy and hassle.
Yeah.
For like 30 quid's worth of
white lightning.
Yeah. I'm like, get champagne at least, guys. Come on. Yeah,
so true. Why would you hold back when the world is your oyster?
Well, maybe that's what mugging should be now, is that somebody just comes up to you in the street and is like, look, I would steal your handbag, but I know it's going to inconvenience you. Can you give me like 40 to 50 pounds?
I think I'd be happier with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just let me keep the copy of the go-between so I don't have to listen to my mother go on about the fact that I lost her copy of the go-between for 20 years.
That was a good crime. Thank you for sharing. So now we move on to the portion of the podcast where we delve into a true crime. Mm. I have the facts. None of you guys do. So I'm going to trickle some information and ask you questions and we will see who is the best detective. It's not a competition. It's a female workplace. A man enters a bank and meets a woman who has been waiting for him. Together, they go to cash a check, but before they can do that, something happens which prevents them. So question, what happens that could stop them cashing a check?
An earthquake.
Great guess.
Is it a great guess? This really is a female workplace. It was a terrible guess.
It didn't occur to me.
I used to work in a bank, and I used to be one of the counter people.
Okay.
Great job, Anna. Clinky things and the paper stuff.
I lost Nationwide a lot of money, but but I remember that there was this elderly woman, and it was a really hot day, and she was wearing a huge fur coat, and she just got £500 cash, and then she collapsed because she was so hot.
Oh.
And I had to phone 999, first time I ever had to phone 999, but I forgot that you needed 9 for an outside line, so I had to ring 9999. It took me a while to work that out. So I think perhaps somebody fainted.
Oh, yeah. Ruth, any advance on this?
Well, if it was now, coronavirus happened and all the banks were shut, so you can't go lockdown. When you say they were like something happened and they couldn't cash it, had they got anywhere or had they just met?
They met, they knew each other, they met, and then together they went to cash the check, and then something happened which prevented them from cashing this check.
A run on the bank, like in Mary Poppins.
Oh, right, yeah, like hyperinflation or something.
Yeah.
No sexier crime than hyperinflation.
That's a really good guess. I thought one of you might guess like the bank got robbed or something. But the true answer is they were arrested by the FBI who had been waiting for them.
Ooh. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Question, what charge do you think they could have been arrested for?
Extortion. Of an old lady who's written the check for them and then they were going to cash the check. Extortion.
Was she wearing a big fur coat?
Yeah.
And just fainted when she realised she'd given them all her fucking money.
Drug trafficking.
Ooh.
Nice. Ooh. Okay.
Or did they rob another bank, but they robbed it, but got a check, so they had to come to another bank.
Like a cashier's check.
They were actually arrested for conspiracy to transport stolen property. What stolen property could they have been transporting?
Was it an automobile?
Nice guess. It is not correct.
We know which era this crime was from, though, because Taylor's put on this voice.
I do that every time.
So we've got cars. Ruth, what do you think?
Wild animals.
Tiger King.
Tiger King, yeah. Was it wild animals? Yeah.
Okay, illegal wild animals, Hannah?
Was it old women in fur coats?
I'm loving it. What it was some forged and stolen letters.
Ooh.
Forged and stolen.
Yes, a combination of both. Would you like to guess what year this is?
Take it away, Taylor.
Well, this is the wrong voice. Ooh, is this like 1970s or 80s?
Nice.
Okay, I think I've clocked vaguely what crime this is, actually. Okay. So, yes, so I will hold back for a moment.
Okay, go on, Ruth.
1948.
Nice, okay.
Hannah, good idea holding back. That's what the police force needs, are detectives that hold back.
information.
I love that. Oh, no, no, I've got it far too early. You guys have a go.
No, then, Hannah, bring it home.
Oh, well, I know the film that's based on it came out in 2019, but when it happened, it was definitely like 70s or 80s. I would say late 70s, 78.
Oh, right. Okay. Now I've blocked it.
So, actually, Taylor is the closest because she said 80s, but it's 1993.
Oh, wow.
So this crime has been made into an Oscar-nominated film. Anyone want to tell me the name of the film or the perps?
Oh, is this the one with Richard E. Grant and Thingy?
Yes!
Yeah!
Yeah!
That's it. That's all I've got for you.
And the winner for Best Actress goes to Thingy.
The Can You Ever Forgive Me film from 2019 with Oscar nominations for Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant.
Is that the full title of the film, The Can You Ever Forgive Me film?
Lee Israel is the perp, and it was based on her autobiography of the same name. It's got all those people in it that we've already said, but it was nominated for like loads of like best adapted screenplay, best actress, yada yada. Not best director, because chicks can't do that.
No.
So you guys have all seen the film, right?
No, I wouldn't.
You know, I don't remember anything ever. So this is going to be a test of like recent memory, and we're on the same page. I'm just going to say that.
I don't remember any films ever that I've watched. And most films, I realized I was chatting to my ex about a film we'd been to see, and I was talking about it, and he went, no, that's not in that film. And what I'd done was I'd conflated four films that we'd been seeing together over the, I don't know, 8 years that we were together. I put them all into one, and he was like, that's not an actual film.
Was it good, though? You could write that.
Yeah. I'm interested in this mashup.
I always find that, like, the best way, if I can't sleep, the best way for me to get to sleep is to, like, sit down and watch a film that really means something to my boyfriend. Because that is when I will fall asleep like that.
Okay, so this film is the story of how a serious writer / celebrity biographer turned to deception to make ends meet. For 3 years, Israel managed to steal, alter, and flat out fabricate around 400 letters, making her one of the most prolific literary forgers in history. Wow. So yay, women represent.
Good girl.
Finally, something we are allowed to get credit for. I'm going to tell you all a little bit about Lee Israel. He was born Carol Israel. It's not even her name. Born Carol Israel in New York in 1939. She earned a bachelor's degree in speech from Brooklyn College in 1961. She spent a lot of her early career as a freelance writer, contributing articles to a wide range of publications, from the New York Times to Soap Opera Digest.
Nice.
I know, right?
So she that is a range.
She had some very good legal success before she went rogue. She was a biographer in the 70s and 80s, and she wrote a book about actress Tallulah Bankhead in 1972 and journalist Dorothy Kilgallen in 1979. And that one made it onto the New York Times bestsellers list when it was released in 1980.
Are you sure it wasn't Soap Opera Digest roundup of the best?
I cannot be sure. That was probably the highlight of her career. It's all downhill from there. Her next book was going to be an unauthorized biography of Estee Lauder.
Estee Lauder isn't really a person, because I always forget that it's a person.
Do you know what? I have a lot of times for like unauthorized biographies, because like I used to have the unauthorized album, like an annual of like everything. You know, when you're a kid and you get like the unauthorized five album.
Yeah.
Like, and so I love it because really, if it's unauthorized, they can write what the fuck they want and they just use slightly pixelated pictures so no one can find out who originally took them or whatever. So I imagine maybe it wasn't as successful because she just it wasn't accurate, maybe.
Or was it that it was just really boring, like maybe Estee Lauder didn't have any, like nothing happened.
I'm gonna give it to Ruth, you're the closest. There's a few things, but that kind of is one of the things that happened. So basically it was released almost simultaneously with Lauder's own memoir. And she'd rushed to finish hers to keep her. And obviously the competition dampened sales. It was panned by the critics. Also, and this leads to what Ruth was saying, the times were changing and the style of biography writing was going out of fashion. The way that Lee Israel did it, she would like meticulously research people, like sleuthing in libraries, just like loads of research. and kind of really kind of create a narrative arc and give precedence like to certain things, and like just sort of try not to put herself into it too much, like the ego of the writer. She would really try and do the subject properly. But now, basically, this time, everything's getting very salacious. There's this person called Kitty Kelly, who are like publishing a lot more kind of muckraking expose type stuff.
Oh my God, yeah, Kitty Kelly.
On people like Jackie Kennedy. Like the market's changing and people start thinking that you need a dollop of vicious smut to sell a biography.
Oh,
you're never going to compete with somebody's memoir, because then it's just like she was seen going into a restaurant, yeah. And her body's like, I was in the restaurant.
Yeah, I know.
Here's what happened. Like, it's never going to be as good.
Crazy, right? Basically, this Estée Lauder book is a failure, and it's her first failure, and it has a profound effect on her.
Right.
And she later considered it a catalyst that sent her in a downward spiral to her later criminal activities.
Oh, damn. I wonder what mine's going to be. I'm really excited about that. Like, I don't think I've had enough success yet. It'll be something, a horrible sitcom that goes terribly wrong and turns out that it's, oh, God, I can't wait to be on a downward spiral of criminality.
Genuinely, I can't relate to someone being that far in their career before they've had a knockback. Like,
right.
You know, this is very much two steps forward, two steps back for me. So, like, I don't get, like, to be like, oh, just perfect trajectory up. And then it's harder to cope with failure. It's better to just be brutally rejected constantly. But so Lee Israel is on record saying, I had never known anything but up in my career, in her memoir.
I know there's a problem with, like, worrying that women aren't likable and we shouldn't talk about that. But that really, like, her likability stock just...
Oh, mate, it's about to jump. It's about to slump even further. So she said in her memoir, I regarded with pity and disdain the short-sleeved wage slaves who worked in offices. I had no reason to believe that life would get anything but better.
She's
not likable.
This is why people have no sympathy for people in the creative industries. Because of women like her. That's why. Because they're like, why should we care about you? Yeah, right. Why should you when there's people like that saying, oh, you wage slaves?
No, completely, completely. Oh. She makes us all look like dicks.
Yeah.
but she's very entitled. But interesting. So actually, and according to other sources, there were like other reasons for the downturn in her career. And some of them are that she's kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Hey, do you want to guess what else went wrong in her career?
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, I guess if she's a dick, then maybe she got, did her agent drop her or something? Was it like, was she awful to her agent?
You're in the right ballpark for sure. Yes. In fact, I'll give you that. Basically, everyone hated her. So
that is a difficulty. Yes.
Like, so basically she was known to be difficult. And like, often if I hear a woman described as difficult, I'm like, or like if a, all I hear is like someone going, this uppity bitch wouldn't give me a blowjob. Like that's enough.
Yeah.
But it does sound like she qualifies for genuinely
difficult.
She was a man who would be being called difficult right now, I think. So she was an alcoholic. Her friend David Yarnell told the New York Times she was very feisty and people did not want to work with her. Her 2015 New York Times obituary described her as having a temperament that made conventional employment nearly impossible.
I love that that's in her obituary as well.
Yeah.
Kind of like, she did this, she did this, she was a nightmare, she did this, she did this.
I called my grandmother feisty once, And she furious with that. It's a sexual term.
Did you call her a feisty little slut, though?
Yeah. I mean, that was the bit she was good about.
So, after the Estee Lauder book, Israel struggled to make ends meet and ultimately went on welfare, which, as you can imagine, she hated after slagging off everyone else. And she was plagued by overdue bills. Question, what was the final straw that pushed Israel to commit a crime? People that have seen the film might know the answer to this.
But what about people that can't remember the film? Yeah.
Was it one of the short-sleeved wage slaves? she had to move back in with her mother.
That's a good guess.
Oh, I think I might remember, but Taylor, I have a guess before because I think I remember, but I'm not sure.
See, I don't think I can remember, but I just vaguely remember a scene with her agent and she just can't get with the times. Is it a rejection? Is it like...
No, so she's like drowning in bills and then something pushes her to...
Is it that I think... I mean, this isn't very impressive because, guys, I think I remember a film I watched a few months ago. Is it that her cat gets sick?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. That would put me over the edge.
Specifically, the cat vets bills. Right, now I've written a joke and you all have to listen to it. Okay, you ready for this?
Yes.
You might say her cat.
Uh-oh.
I'm laughing because it's so bad. The catalyst.
Oh, brilliant.
And that is solid wordplay. Don't at me. And this is completely accurately represented in the film. The cat had to go to the vets for tests, and she couldn't come up with the $40 that she needed to get the pay to get the results back for the tests that the cat had to have. Does anyone know or can guess what was Israel's first crime?
It's a shame because if it was just a child, you'd be like, well,
yeah.
We'll just roll the dice here, I guess.
That is harsh, though, isn't it? Taking something in for testing and then being like, yeah, but you've got to give me the $40 to get the results. Like, surely that seems really cruel. No,
brutal, brutal capitalism.
Did she forge a letter to the vet?
Ooh. From the cat.
Initially, she did not do forgery. She just did simple theft. And so she happened to be working on an article about the comedian and singer, actress Fanny Bryce for Soap Opera Digest. Oh, I'll read you her quote. It happened incrementally, like most evil things do, she told NPR in 2008. I went to the library and was given a bunch of letters which I should not have been given in a non-secure area. Tempted by the possibility, Israel tucked a few letters from actress Fanny Bryce into her shoes and walked out with them. And then she sold them to this Argosy, like a rare bookstore.
Oh, wow. So she wasn't even forging. This time it was just a legit
yeah,
letter.
A legit theft and sale.
I love how she blames, like, which I should not have been given.
I was in an area that I shouldn't have been in.
So she made $40 for each letter, which was not too suspicious.
But like, how many letters does she have?
Two, I think.
She could have got her cat tested twice for that.
Her quote about this is that she, for the first time in a long time, I had some jingle in my jeans.
Is that cystitis? What's that?
No wonder her book didn't go down well. Imagine if that was your prose style.
So cat fans will be pleased to know that she got the test back and was able to treat her cat. So far, so good. Crime pays. Basically, you guys know that she refined her scheme to forgery to make more money. She ends up doing quite intricate forgery. And the stepping stone is there was a big space at the bottom of one of the Fanny Bryce letters after Yours Truly, Fanny Bryce. So she got an old typewriter. She describes that she wrote a couple of hot sentences that improved the letter and elevated the price.
Wow, she's really got a lot of self-confidence, hasn't she?
Also, that's quite interesting, though, because I was thinking, you know, with forgery, you're like, oh, is it handwriting forgery? But actually, back in the day, everyone would probably have similar typewriters. There's no kind of millions and millions of fonts. You can just add it in and just be like...
She did end up getting, like, vintage paper. She acquired old typewriters because there would have been, although they weren't fonts specifically... There would have been like this age of typewriter would have looked like this. So she actually had to get a spectrum of, and they did show this in the film actually.
I love this era of no technology where it's like, I just have to do these little steps and make it look antiquated. Nobody can check me.
Yeah.
It's kind of exciting.
Mm. It is. And she can, and it's like this really weird little cottage industry as well. So like no one's really checking because they're selling them on for like way more money and stuff. So she got all this vintage paper out of like period journals in libraries. She's still nicking and destroying stuff.
I mean, we're kind of team Israel, but not quite. That sounds, but I mean, team Lee Israel, but.
I admire her spirit, but I bet she'd be a nightmare person.
Did you ever at school, did you used to like, we had to at one point like write a letter from a pirate. So we'd put the paper in like some tea and then you set fire to the side and almost set fire to your entire homework. I think I could do this, is what I'm saying.
I tried to do this with my kid and she was so unimpressed, where you write on it with lemon juice and then you can see the secret writing.
But she's got a fucking iPad, hasn't she? That's why she's not.
Oh, they're so jaded, Katie. I know. It's so sad.
Also, all these typewriters and forgery and papers and stuff, genuinely to me, sounds more like work than a proper job would have been. She's getting a kick out of tricking people, but also she is exercising the writing muscle in her brain. You know, she's got to come up with really pithy stuff that sounds like it would be this person. So she's actually really enjoying that challenge, I think. So the letters were so convincing that two of them featured in the Letters of Noel Coward, published by Alfred A. Knopf in 2007, over 10 years after Israel pleaded guilty for her crimes.
Wow. But it is amazing, though, isn't it, that like the letters, she can be found guilty of that, and then someone's like, oh, pop them in the book, we haven't got enough.
I mean, but also they never got found, because the thing is, they found out the big ones, which we'll get to. But there were so many just floating around because she did loads for low money because she thought that would be less suspicious than like big ones.
How did they know that the ones that were in the 10 years afterwards, did she then go, oh, those are mine? Yeah.
She would as well, wouldn't she?
I mean, I don't know about you, but as freelancers who aren't really being supported right now, like my wheels are turning. It's the version of this that I can do right fucking now.
She did something too suspicious on a letter that led to one of the stepping stones that got her found out.
Did she do like a heart over an eye?
Actually, you're in the right ballpark.
Oh, wow.
That is not what she did. She made an embellishment that was not.
Oh, wow. She was like, love Dorothy Parker. And she kissed the paper with red lipstick.
Again, good guess.
Did she try and imply a sort of relationship between two people that wasn't there?
You're the closest, but still no. She made references to Noel Coward's sexuality, but in a way that would not have, it was still illegal at that time.
Yeah.
So there was no way he would have been that open in a letter in that particular era.
Well, thank God for homophobia, guys. I'm going to be the first to say it.
It really helps solve crime. This attracted the attention of some of her buyers, and a New York dealer demanded $5,000 in exchange for not testifying against her before a grand jury.
So she's being blackmailed on top of all of this?
Yes. It was the end of Israel's sales of forged letters, but not her work as a literary forger.
Ooh.
Having decided that selling her fictionalized creations was too risky, Israel instead opted to go back to her original MO, but with a twist.
Oh,
soap opera digest nude.
Did she do spoilers for soap operas?
I bet she'd think that she could write better stories as well, so she'd just do her own version of.
Did she write unauthorized biographies as if they were autobiographies?
That's a great idea.
Her new plan was to go into the archives of prestigious libraries, examine the existing letters, figuring out how to create the perfect forgeries of them. Then she would go home, create that forgery, and return to the library, put a replica in the place, steal the original, and then leave, basically. So Jack Hopp, or Richard E. Grant to you and me, would then sell the legitimate letter to the private collectors. So everything's going great again. She's got cat food for days. Also, as Taylor has pointed out, this is the pre-internet 90s, and the trade in literary memorabilia was a sketchy cottage industry powered by greed and bad faith, and a lot of the dealers came to suspect that Israel was passing off fakes, but they were happy to slip her £50 in cash. $50. I may have done that a few times before selling them on for three times that amount. So no one was getting hurt, and she felt that she was being paid for her professional skills. This is where, and this guy's, we're not going to dwell on him too long, but he's a big figure in why she gets busted. Enter David H. Lowenhart. He's an autograph dealer in New York. He discovered news that the missive from Ernest Hemingway to Norman Cousins that he had purchased was in fact a part of Columbia University's collection. He got in contact with the university, and together they discovered the forgery in its place.
Oh.
Question. How did they trace this back to Lee Israel?
Cat litter.
It's even better than that.
Is it just she'd signed it out? Like she signed out that... I mean, come on.
It was on her library card.
Oh, boy, error.
Oh, no. So she signed it. And then it is kind of like the forgery version of wearing a stripy jumper.
It's like, well, the ultimate attention would be a prison sentence.
There, the FBI was able to uncover significantly more of Israel's forged works, and the stolen letters she had sold were returned to their archives, though the FBI agent in charge of the case told the Times in 2015 that it was likely more letters remained undiscovered. So, as we know, there was kind of a sting. We're going to go back to the bank now at the beginning.
I had forgotten about the bank.
David H. Lowenhart wore a wire when Jack Hock, Richard E. Grant, sold him the next letter, and then bang, they arrest Hock and Israel trying to cash the check. Question, did Israel plead guilty?
Yes, he did.
He did guilty to one count of conspiracy to transport stolen property in interstate commerce in 1993. Her sentence was 6 months house arrest with 5 years probation.
Wow, 6 months house arrest. Like, that's what we've all been sentenced to right now.
Okay, she said, my success as a forger was somehow in sync with my erstwhile success as a biographer. I had for decades practiced a kind of merged identity with my subjects. To say I channeled is only a slight exaggeration. She had to be really careful. So in her letters, she'd have to be like more Ernest Hemingway than Ernest Hemingway to be convincing as Ernest Hemingway. She thought it was a real art and it was great. Also, she said, the forged letters were larky and fun and totally cool.
Is that what she said?
Yeah.
So weird.
Imagine describing your crime as like, it's totally cool.
I really feel like she's like a hippie. She's like she came of age in the 60s and that's how she talks. After this, she did a time such as it was. I mean, she just basically had to sit through the coronavirus. So she then managed to work again. She got loads of writing work afterwards and she wrote her own memoir. Fun fact. The title of the memoir is deliberately naff because it's a knowing and winky face kind of thing. It's from this closing of a letter that Israel forged for Dorothy Parker. In one of the letters, Dorothy Parker writes, Alan told me to write and apologize, so I'm doing that now whilst he dresses for our turkey dinner with the boys across the road. I have a hangover and that is a real museum piece. I'm sure that I must have said something terrible. To save me this kind of exertion in the future, I'm thinking of having the letters run off saying, can you ever forgive me, Dorothy? And then... Parker, but Israel, signs off with that phrase. And Alan in the letter was meant to be Parker's husband, Alan Campbell. So basically it's this like fake apology because Dorothy Parker would never apologize. And clearly nor with Israel, she hasn't apologized.
Dorothy Parker was like one of her main things though, wasn't it? Like at least from the movie, it made out that...
a lot of Dorothy Parker and Hemingway and Noel Coward and... There was a bit where, like, Noel Coward, like, slagged off Julie Andrews' overbite and said that she looked way better since she's fixed her teeth and stuff. And that was Israel.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It's almost like the person that's not invited to the party. So they're like, I'm going to rewrite your fucking party.
Like, actually, that's a really great description. That really is the vibe, I think. She's like, fuck you then. Here's what I'm going to do. Like, I think it really is that. Oh, there was one thing that I thought was fun as well. That in the film, they show that Lee Israel's being ignored by her agents and stuff. So she keeps like pretending, like ringing them, pretending to be Nora Ephron. And then when they actually come to the phone, he shouts, star fucker, and hangs up.
I remember that really happened.
That's really true. And Nora Ephron's people had to get a cease and desist order.
Oh, that's pretty...
In the film, I do remember that scene, one of those scenes in the film, and it's just really funny, just how much glee she seems to get out of, and to her own agent, you fucking...
I know, she's really hurting, and then it is just so funny as well, though, like...
That's great.
Drunk women solving crime.
We have just enough time for a listener crime.
Ooh.
And this is one that somebody wrote in a review, I think. And they said, in case you were ever stuck for a listener crime, thank you, we are. I was woken up at 5:30 a.m. to find an escaped convict climbing in my bedroom window to leave me a note, like the milk tray man, but with less chocolate.
What?
Is that all the information we have?
That is all the information we have.
What the fuck? That's too little and too much all at once.
A note or him, I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like we need to reply to this. And like, can you even reply to these things and say, like, what did the note say?
How does the person know that they would, that the convict was just leaving a note?
Yeah.
Surely that would be what the convict would say they were doing. Oh, I was just going to leave a note. Also, that it's an escaped convict, which makes me think it was in like the 1700s or something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
very convict.
Very Dickens.
Yeah.
But like,
what would they be wearing?
No.
Yeah. How do they know it's an escaped convict?
I'm picturing stripy outfit and a swag bag.
Yeah. Right.
Cartoonish.
And like a ball and chain that they've hiked up with them.
And he's like had to bring it with him.
What's that thing, you know, a grappling hook he uses? His ball and chain is a grappling hook.
Yeah.
I mean, we have so many questions.
So many.
Maybe he was later caught and that's how they know he was a convict.
Maybe.
Or maybe this person was going out with them, knew that they were in prison.
Ooh.
And they came in through the window and they were like, oh, you're not meant to be out yet.
Ooh, yeah.
It'd be interesting to know where this happened because, like, coming from the Isle of Wight, we've got three of the fuckers. We've got three prisons on the Isle of Wight.
Right.
Yeah, we're like a kind of a very English Alcatraz. And but we have, like, the main ones as well. We have the Krays. Like, the Krays were in our prison. Gary Glitter is there right now.
Wow, I did not realize, Hannah George. You're a penal colony. Ooh, I mean, baby. I knew you were a penal colony, but...
But, yeah, no, I think we did solve it. And you can't come from the Isle of Wight and talk about prisons and not assert how many prisons you come from.
Cheers, we solved it.
Cheers.
Okay, we have just enough time. Ruth, tell us, what are you up to apart from coronavirus?
I'm just sitting waiting for someone to give me a job. I'm waiting for the coronavirus lockdown to be lifted so that people can... I think life is much better with an audience.
Yeah.
And it's very hard. And I see all these people making content for online and I'm like, oh, stop. Yeah. You have to stop.
Yeah.
Stop. Because they're also, you know, and you can see it's because they're sort of desperate for...
Yeah.
You know. But I think if the cinemas are open, then the People Who Just Do Nothing film, I think, is coming out in August.
Oh, awesome. That's so cool.
Fingers crossed.
Good. Is that in Japan or something?
Yeah, I didn't get to go to Japan.
You didn't go?
No. Oh. They all went and had a lovely time, but I did.
Oh, man.
People Just Do Nothing, the movie, big in Japan.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Nice. And that's August.
That's August. I think it's August.
Ruth, thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I've had so much fun and it's been lovely having two little glasses of gin. Got a right glow on now.
Thank you so much, Ruth. You're amazing.
Oh, thank you so much.
Drunk Women Solving Crime is produced by Amanda Redman. Music by The Lion and the Wolf. If you would like to, you can follow us on Drunk Women Pod on Twitter, on Facebook and Insta. We are Drunk Women Solving Crime. And please review us on Apple Podcasts. And also, if you have a crime that you would like us to solve, write it on a review on Apple Podcasts as well. Thank you to Acast and thank you for listening. Bye!
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.